Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, happy Monday, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill. Today's show is brought to you by Markham Search, an executive and search staffing firm based out of New York City with offices along the East Coast and now in California as well, providing staffing solutions and executive search solutions to companies and law firms throughout the United States. Today, we have with us on the show Robin Hayes. Professor Hayes is a professor of microbiology at Hartnell College in Salinas, California. He has a graduate degree from Humboldt State University from Arcata, California, and more than 25 years as a researcher, analyst, and educator. Professor Hayes has conducted research at Stanford's Hopkins Marine Station and developed educational material for the Monterey Bay Aquarium. He has served as the senior analyst for the nation's largest water reclamation project. Professor Hayes considers himself a general biologist with a broad but limited knowledge of most things biological. He is a fan of genetics and cell research and is fascinated by the field of quantum mechanics. He enjoys taking photos of mushrooms from what he calls the gnome's perspective. His first book examines the biology behind behavior at the cellular level. What are the factors and influences determining our decisions, and how can we better use this information? Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Hayes.
Well, thank you for having me, Jennifer. Nice to be here.
Yeah, so I love this concept. Are we more biologically suited to some jobs than others? Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how you became fascinated with biology, and then we'll dive into how biology relates or maybe doesn't relate to a job seeker's job hunt.
Sure. Well, my fascination with biology began at a fairly young age with curiosity and wanting to know why things were the way they were. And then when I got into college, it just blossomed into a deep desire to just know about the world around us and why plants were green and why animals did what they did and eventually why we do what we do. So my interest in biology started early and just blossomed and grew over time.
So tell me, what inspired the book? Was there a particular moment where you thought, I need to write a book about this, or that inspired you to look at what our cells make us do or don't make us do?
Well, it was one of those things that kind of came to me over time, many years of watching bacteria and watching protozoa, which are single-celled organisms, watching how they respond and behave, and then observing students and observing colleagues and stuff, and just having conversations with colleagues, I started to get this feel for why we behave the way we do. And that it, to me, it seemed like it was one of these things that was determined by how our cells were responding. And so when you looked deep into behavior and the causes for behavior, I realized that there seemed to be three main elements, our genetics, our experience, and our emotions, our education. So these things all led to our understanding of, or my understanding, I should have, of why we were responding as we did and why we did what we did. And so I thought I'd sit down and try to explain to people I know and even to myself, if you will, why I was doing what I was doing and why people do what they do.
So for some of our listeners out there who might be thinking the same thing I'm thinking is, are we predetermined to be a certain way, or to what extent do we have control over how we're biologically designed?
Right. And that's a good question. And it's one of the things that I tried to address in my book, about the last third of the book, after building the biological base and understanding the last third of the book, really looks at our free will decisions and are they really free will decisions? And I would say that with regards to predetermined, no, I don't think behavior is predetermined. In my opinion, behavior is an in the moment response. I say that it's determined, determined by what's going on in the moment. And these factors, as I've mentioned, there are experience, there are environment, there are genetics. These things are what's going to influence our in-the-moment response. But the universe itself, because of what I've learned through quantum mechanics and my interest in quantum mechanics, the universe itself, I would say, is not predetermined, despite what Einstein might have imagined. I don't believe it is. You know, Lawrence Krauss has shown or in one of his books discussed how particles come into and out of existence. And so that provides a certain randomness, if you will, or a certain uncertainty to the universe. So I don't think there is a predetermined to the universe, but I do think our responses are determined, but they're determined by what's going on in the moment.
Yeah, this is such a sticky subject because, like you just said, you know, Einstein, 100 years ago, a couple hundred years ago, we thought the world was one way. And now you have new studies like you were talking about, quantum mechanics, you have epigenetics. And I was reading something in a book this weekend that was related to biology, talking about how genes aren't, what was the word I think it was used, self-emerging, and that they almost need a trigger. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that? Like, say that you have a musical inclination. Let's say your mother or father played music. Does that person perhaps have a gene that could be activated or triggered or might not be triggered, and that would give you perhaps going down one path versus another path?
Most certainly that's a possibility. Sure, that's a little bit more specific than what we know at this time, but what we are starting to learn with regards to epigenetics is that our genes can be turned on or off by what's going on in our environment. One of the first places that this effect influences us is in the womb, of course, with what is happening in our mother's environment. It turns out our genes can become methylated, and that's what happens at this epigenetic level, is that they become methylated, and when that happens, the gene essentially has been shut off.
Hmm.
And what causes the methylation, what causes the methylation can be a number of factors. A lot of times it can be, you know, the mother's diet. It could be the pollution she's being exposed to. It could be drugs that she's being exposed to. All of these things can influence her child's epigenetic genome. And then that, of course, once he's born and growing, influences his development. And so you can have your genes turned on or turned off based, we know certainly by what's in your mother's environment, but we're starting to realize that it also can happen with what's going on in your own environment. Turns out that exercise seems to have an epigenetic effect.
Hmm.
Again, this is somewhat experimental and I think it's controversial to a certain degree. More research needs to be done, but preliminary studies suggest that exercise can have an epigenetic effect on a whole host of different genes that then aid the individual when they do work out, so that their workouts are better and their cells respond better. Just on the cusp of this epigenetic idea, I think our microbiota, the organisms that inhabit both our gut and you know, our skin and stuff, also may influence our epigenetics. We do know that these microorganisms are releasing you know, various compounds and stuff that can influence our mood, can influence, you know, our responses at certain times. So we're starting to understand that. And I wouldn't think it's too much of a reach to expect that these microbiota are also influencing our epigenetics.
Oh my gosh. So it makes it sound like we're just made up with these, I don't know if it would be millions or trillions of little single cells, and they're running our lives and we have nothing to do with it.
Well, it would be trillions. And I know it kind of feels that way. It certainly feels that way. But that's why I say it's a necessary illusion. We certainly can't know all of the factors and variables that go into why we do what we do. But when we look at our cellular behavior and what's going on, we can often find the fundamental causes for the choices and decisions that we make. And here's the interesting thing. It's an emotional response. In almost every case, what we're talking about when we make a decision, a choice to take this job or that job, or when we choose our mates, and even the simplest decisions of choosing what to have for dinner, are all emotional responses. There's just a little emotional kick. There's one thing you prefer over the other, even if you think in your evaluations are equal. One thing is for some reason, subconsciously, you like better. So you get this little emotional kick, and then that helps you with your decision.
So that leads into a whole other set of questions. Are our emotions driven by biology, i.e. I see a piece of food that I'm interested in, or a potential mate that interests me, or I get a release of some sort of endorphin or hormone when I go into a job interview that tells me this is it? Are those actual biological things, or what role do emotions actually play in biology?
Well, emotions are biology, but it's our environment that triggers those emotion. So anytime we have an emotional response, it really is the release of neurotransmitters from our cells, or hormones from our cells. These chemicals then make their way into the bloodstream and to the appropriate cells, and sometimes they're just in the brain cells that they're responding to, a back and forth that's going on. But these chemicals that are being released then influence, if not dictate, our behavior. And I can give you several examples, but for instance, with regards to mate choice, in my book, I talk about MHC molecules. These are molecules that are on the surface of your white blood cells, and they're involved in your immune response. And it would make sense that you would want to have a great variety of these MHC molecules. Well, it turns out that women have the ability to sense their mates, MHC molecules, or potential mates, MHC molecules, through his odor, his sweat, the pheromones that he's given off. She's picking up on his MHC molecules, and studies have shown that she prefers a mate that has different, less similar MHC molecules. And then she will find herself more attracted to that individual.
Is the same thing true of when we go into a job hunting situation? Because I know for myself and for many of the job seekers I've represented over the years from the recruiting side of things, I know that there are people where sometimes you walk in and you just kind of get these giddy feelings, or this is it, I've come home. Is it possible that even from an employment standpoint that we're kind of releasing these neurotransmitters, as you explained, that are telling us this is good or bad, or is it more specific only to mate selection?
No, not at all. Absolutely, it can. You can have these kinds of reactions in a job setting or a interview setting, a situation like that. The hormone oxytocin, which is one that is involved in lactation and other things, also plays a role in our trust of individuals. And somebody that has a high level of oxytocin, it's going to be much more trusting of people. And it turns out we can actually subconsciously trigger a person's oxytocin release by lightly touching them on the elbow or touching them on the shoulder or something like this. Little touches like that cause a release of oxytocin, and then that person is somewhat more trusting of the individual. But it isn't just the touching of people, inanimate objects can also influence our opinions. Turns out there was a study done with regards to interviewing potential candidates, and the person asking the question preferred or had a bias towards individuals when he was holding a heavier clipboard than when he was holding a lighter clipboard. So if you handed your resume to the individual on a sturdy, heavy clipboard, he had a bias towards you. He liked you better than one where the clipboard was light. Same is true interview situation. If the interviewee had a cup of warm coffee versus cold tea, he found you more appealing. The bias was in your favor.
That is incredible. I know that there was a great TED Talk, and I'm going to forget who it was. It was a couple, Amy Coulter, I want to say was her name. And it's been something that we've been referencing for years, where they did a study where they had candidates go in. They did a double-blind study, I think it was, where one set of applicants was told to go in and interview the normal way, just as though it was a normal interview. And then the other group of 10 interviewees was told to go and stretch their body and make their body as big as possible right before the interview. Obviously, don't do this in somebody's lobby, but maybe downstairs before you head up to the interview. And the people who stretched were found in this double-blind study to be more desirable of candidates than those who weren't. And the interviewer could not tell you what it was that made these other candidates more desirable. And long story short, I think it did relate to something related to biology about endorphins or something that got released at a subconscious level and therefore increased the confidence of the other candidates. But it really is mind-boggling how this all plays into our success or failure as human beings.
Well, absolutely. We can be so easily manipulated by what's going on in our environment. And it's important in trying to determine, or when you talk about success, it's important to understand our reactions to certain triggers or cues or things like that. Trigger is one of those trendy words right now, but you understand what I'm saying. A lot of times it can be, or we've seen studies where color can influence a person's mood and things like that, but your experiences and the stuff that you remember, those are sitting there in your subconscious, and sometimes they can come up and affect your mood without you ever realizing it, simply because you now find yourself in a similar situation as to one where maybe things didn't go as well for you and so your mood is down, or maybe where things went really well for you and your mood is up. So we find that, our success a lot of times can be somewhat dictated, determined by our mood or our reaction to the environment triggers that are going on.
Yeah, we had an interesting thing with a job seeker who came in to interview with our office recently, and I was wearing a kind of like a seafoam green colored dress. And he said to one of my associates, he said, "Wow, what a pleasing color. It just put me so at ease in the interview." And it's true, because I mean, if you could imagine if somebody was perhaps wearing all black or a very bright red, it might be off-putting to somebody in interview, versus wearing more serene, calming colors might cause the people to feel more at ease in the interview. And it would have never even occurred to me had this person not said that recently.
Yeah, absolutely. You can imagine how in any situation, when you put another person into that situation, the entire environment changes completely. You're by yourself, your behaviors are different than when somebody comes in. And then how that person reacts to you affects your response to them. And what we know is that the response back and forth really is a biological response based on the types of hormones and neurotransmitters you're releasing in your response to that individual, be it the hormones and stuff that they're giving off, or even the body language and the words that come out of their mouth and the other things that they might do.
Well, let's talk for a minute, because so I know your book is My Cells Made Me Do It, which is just an awesome title. And I love that whole concept of, did our cells actually make us do it? That is the question that we're here to find out. So tell our listeners a little bit about how their cells are going to impact their job choice, or does it have an impact on their job choice or their success or failure in that choice?
Well, in this regard, I think, first of all, it's important to understand that there's a genetic base that we are building from, right? So some people are just going to have a predisposition to do certain things better than other people. And it's not just in their skill and talent level necessarily, but also in their temperament. Some people are going to just, because of their genes, genetically have a different temperament than other people. So you have this base that you're going to be building from. And then, of course, you have your childhood that maybe wrecked you. Who knows? But the experiences from your childhood also have been added to this genetic base. And so you have all of this to deal with initially, right? So you understand you have these things that are going to influence the decisions that you make, because they are part of you and your experience. Now, with regards to what you would maybe prefer to do or not do as a job, I think a lot of times we know what we want to do because ourselves are telling us. We have, like I said, this emotional response to the things that we like to do. And so we kind of gravitate to those types of fields and professions. And when we do that, obviously, you know, life can be such that you get forced to do something you don't like doing at all. But when we do gravitate towards the things that cause us pleasure, obviously we perform better in those jobs and we excel.
Yeah, and I know when you and I talked prior to the show, the other thing we were talking about is there are just genetic predispositions, you know. It's like, at what point do you let your genetics stop you? Because when you and I were prepping for the show, we were talking about, okay, you might not be a linebacker if you weigh 150 pounds. But at what point does free will intervene? And, you know, that person who's told they can't do something because they're not genetically predisposed still sometimes shocks and amazes us all and goes on to be an extraordinary basketball or football player or scientist, despite what either nature or nurture would have taught us otherwise.
Well, I'll push back there and tell you that they were predisposed to do that because they did it. The fault was in us and our interpretation of their skills or abilities. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a bravo to them for pushing forward against the negativity that they encountered. But I would argue that they did have the predisposition because they accomplished what they set out to do. We get caught up in, like I said, the 5'5", 150-pound linebacker. You know, we put these parameters, we put these restrictions on people because that's what our experience shows us. Have we ever seen such an individual do that? No. But here's the thing. That individual had the predisposition, and not so much physically, physical stature, but in drive and motivation. And that's what pushed them past all of the other negativity that we were getting. So although I do seriously believe we have genetic predispositions for what we can do in our skills and talents and stuff, I believe drive and motivation is also part of that predisposition.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, because I think this is a fascinating topic to understand, like what has one person have more drive than the next person? Like you could even have two siblings who might be similar in most ways, had a similar environment growing up, and yet one person is driven to no end and that other person could care less and be happy to live the rest of their life lackadaisically and not pushing past anything other than the essential needs being met. So where does biology play into that drive and ambition? Is that something that has been found in biology or genetics to be present that makes a difference?
Well, I think we are just starting to understand which genes contribute to behavior. It's difficult to say, well, this gene is responsible for drive, or this gene is responsible for behavior, although we are starting to get a better feel for it, understand for it. But with regards to what could happen with twins and one being driven and one not being driven, I would go back to this notion of the methylation of the genes being turned on or off. You know, identical twins aren't really identical. The blood flow to those twins is going to be somewhat different. One twin's going to get blood before the other twin. Their fingerprints will be different. And what I'm trying to get to, I guess, is that in some case, you might expect that their genes will be methylated differently as well. And so you could see a situation where in the womb, just because of the slightly different environments that both of the children they have, one's going to be on the right side, one's going to be on the left side, right? That
True.
Makes a difference in the end or in what's going on molecularly. And so you could have a situation where one is driven and one isn't simply because of what happened in the womb and which genes got methylated. But let's say that didn't happen in the womb, and we're now talking about young adults. The diet that changes the microbiota And we are starting to see that as well, that, you know, types of foods that we eat have a big influence on the types of gut microbes we have. And so the diets that change the microbiota can also influence mood and maybe influence drive. And so you can see a situation where twins, where one has maybe a really good diet because he's in a situation where a good diet is available to him, and the other twin doesn't have that same opportunity, might have a different microbiota, gut flora, and that could influence his cells, the methylation of his genes, and ultimately his drive and motivation. I'm speculating to a degree here, but you can see how the biological influence is there.
I feel like somebody is playing racquetball with our future or with how we're designed. It's between you have the diet and the flora and the fauna and the microbiology and the things in our guts multiplied times the genes that were turned on or off in our mother's womb. It's so funny because I'm very much, I love science and it was one of my favorite subjects in school. And yet I went kind of more the social sciences route in college of more psychology and trying to understand the brain, but not from the biological standpoint. So mm-hmm. I like to believe that I am in charge and in control of everything. And because I say so, life is great. And you're telling me something entirely different, Professor. So I have a bone to pick with you on that.
Well, it's true that we are easily manipulated. This is why advertising works. It's why propaganda works. It's why the Safeway or the supermarkets put groceries on the end caps and, you know, spur of the moment purchases on the end caps, because we are so easily manipulated. Our moods are so easily manipulated. When we start to realize that, it gives us a little bit more, a little bit more control over our response. I still think the response is somewhat determined, but now it's determined because I understand what's going on.
So how could we apply this? How could myself or somebody who's listening out there, who's feeling frustrated perhaps personally or professionally and wants to go out there and start to shift things? Yes, we understand the genetic foundation of what you've described. And obviously, everybody should go buy your book. My cells made me do it so that way they can get a full picture. But in this short 30, 40 minutes or so that we have together, what are any steps that our listeners or anybody out there who's faced with these sorts of obstacles could take to begin to, like you say, get more control, and rather than just being these reactive multi-trillion cell single organisms all moving around together, responding to stimuli?
Well, I think if the easiest thing for us to do, for us to control to a certain degree, is our environment. Obviously, we can't control our genetics. They are what they are to a certain degree. And our experiences, you know, they've already happened. You can't change them. And they are a part of your makeup. So the three elements that influence our behavior, the one that's left really is our environment. And so I think when we focus on our environment and doing the things that will improve our environment and maybe help us achieve the successes that we want, that's then when we start to maybe mature as an individual and understand what needs to happen to go forward. The environment could be simply removing yourself from a toxic situation where, you know, maybe you're in a bad relationship, or maybe you're being exposed to secondhand smoke or drugs or some other situation, or maybe it's putting yourself in a situation where you're around individuals that are doing the things that you want to do as well, so that you start to get that positive feedback, if you will. So there's, in my opinion, I think environment is probably the thing that we have the most control over. And part of the environment might be our diet as well, because that's going to affect our microbiota, and that I think is so important to understand how important our microbiota is to our mood, our how we feel, and just our overall behavior.
So I'm curious about that because there are so many fad diets out there. There's the paleo diet, the no sugar this, the all sugar, the, again, I'm making that up, but all these different fads. How, as a layperson who doesn't have a background in biology, how should we know what's going to increase our happiness, vitality, and well-being without, like you said, just being persuaded by marketing or whatever somebody is telling me is supposed to be good for me? How do we actually know what's going to increase our health and vitality and well-being?
Well, we're going to have to do a little bit of research. And part of that is just, you know, reading up on the foods that you like. You know, it's important that we're still eating stuff that we like. But I think the other part of that is how you feel and how your body is responding. We have seen that women that go from being heavy and heavy set that lose weight, in part, weight reduction is because the microbiota has changed in their gut flora. So I think it requires us to have some understanding of ourselves and what we like and don't like, and then also some understanding of diets in general and biology in general. So we do have to do a little bit of research. And I think it's pretty obvious, and I'm not a dietitian, but I think it's pretty obvious that, you know, there's certain foods that are just bad for us, but they're hard to stay away from. And a lot of times those bad foods, if we have a significant portion of our diet eating those bad foods, it dramatically impacts our microbiota. So I just think, I don't want to do an advertisement for diets or anything. I think we have to do research for ourselves and find out which one works for us. Because I'm sure that in all those diets you mentioned, in each one, there's individuals those diets work for, but obviously there are individuals those diets don't work for. I don't know if I have a good answer for you there.
Yeah, I think it's just about, like you said, doing your due diligence, gaining awareness. I think the first step, you know, one of my friends, Pam, who I had on the show, I think it was last January, actually lost about over 130 pounds and has kept it off for 5 years and is happy and healthy. You know, she made different life choices and chose different things. But I think it all begins with self-care and self-awareness. It's that moment when you look at yourself and say, this isn't the job I want. This isn't the relationship I want. And then you have that honest conversation with yourself and say, okay, what could I change? And even for job seekers, I've seen it happen where people just aren't cognizant of what they're putting in their body, and it can have a negative impact on their body. People come into interviews and they're jittery from too much coffee, or not aware at all from too little, or maybe it's just a general lethargicness from not taking care of their health and well-being. And I would be interested to throw this at you. Biologically, I would imagine that if you have somebody who presents in an interview as healthy, vibrant, well-balanced, in other words, they're not swaying one side to the left or the right of extremely jittery, intense, and high-strung, or very lethargic and unresponsive, those are probably biologically going to stimulate the interviewer to go, oh, this person seems like a good match or a bad match based on how they biologically present as far as their health and well-being. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
No, you're absolutely right about that. There was a study done a few years back where they assessed students' first impressions of their professors, and they would have them write their response after 10 seconds of a video they watched of the professor. So it wasn't even a live presentation. And then compared that to their position at the end of the semester, and most of the students' responses initially were the same as they were at the end of the semester. So we make a very quick judgment of people. And so if you walk in to an interview and you're presenting yourself like you're a healthy individual, that's going to be picked up on right away. And it is going to have a positive bias on the interviewee. And I know exactly what you're talking about. I was in a similar situation when I was working at one of my lab jobs, where we were interviewing candidates for a technician position. And a young lady comes in and she's very disheveled and sits down for the interview. And right away, before we've even heard any of her answers, she's already presented herself in a negative light. And so she may be a great technician, but now she's got to bring herself, her answers have to lift herself above the way she's presenting herself. And it's not like the interviewees have any choice in their response to what they see. You know, they're going to respond automatically. And I think that's the thing we have to recognize as well with regards to, you know, cellular determinism and how we respond. The person on the other side is going to respond automatically as well, or somewhat determined by what we present to them. And so when we come into an interview all disheveled, they're going to see that immediately. And then on the other side, if we come in, you know, dressed and looking sharp and looking healthy, and that includes, you know, good night's sleep and, you know, bags under the eyes and your hair combed and, you know, teeth brushed. You got to look good. And when you see that, when the other person sees that, they're going to respond automatically. I just read a line, and I can't remember it, so I shouldn't try to say it, but it's something about the reason that people are beautiful, or the reason beauty evolved, is because it works. You know, it's selected for. So
yeah,
I paraphrased.
It's okay. But, we'll forgive you on that one, Professor. You don't always have to get your facts right.
Right.
Well, so you've given us a lot to think about. You know, tell my listeners, tell everybody out there, is there anything that you want people to walk away from today's, you know, interview? Is there anything that's some salient point or two that you would love people to remember from today's show?
Well, if we're trying to change our behavior, if you're not happy with the way that we can go about that, one is to reflect on what we've done and the decisions we make and think about why those decisions came about. And then when we go forward, recognize that the decisions we are making are in the moment decisions with a little bit of an emotional push. It just helps us understand why we do what we do. And it also helps us understand why others do what they do. If we recognize they're responding in the moment as well to what's being presented to them. And maybe that's what we are presenting to them, or maybe it's what else is going on in the environment.
I think that's great. So tell people, please, where they could find your book and anywhere or any website that you want to let people know about more information on you.
Sure. Well, you can get it at Amazon, of course, and Barnes & Noble. But you can find it on my website at celldeterminism.com. Celldeterminism, C-E-L-L, determinism.com. And if you purchase it from my website, I'll send you a signed copy.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Professor Hayes. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show today. I love this subject. We could talk about it for hours. So thank you for sharing your biological wisdom with those of us out there and helping us to understand how it interrelates with our job search and our success or failure in life. And as always, thank you so much to everybody who tuned in today. If you missed any portion of the show, you can find it available for download immediately following the show on the LA Talk Radio website under the Get Yourself the Job page in the archives section. The show will also be available on iTunes later in the week under Get Yourself the Job on iTunes. We invite you to subscribe, listen at your leisure, and also leave us any feedback, comments, anything that you'd like. We always appreciate your feedback and appreciate you tuning in. So thanks for tuning in. Thank you for joining us, Professor Hayes, and I look forward to having you join us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, and look forward to having everybody tune in next Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Have a wonderful rest of your week.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.